Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
What's the shortest time you've owned a car? From what I've gathered, you've only ever owned about three.
One.
Literally,
so it's actually the longest I've owned a dick.
Welcome to the Collecting Addicts podcast, episode number 20. Fanfare, fireworks, cymbal, percussion. What an amazing achievement to have wasted 20 something hours of your time. We're sorry, but we're carrying on. To start with, this week, Formula One versus the Indy 500, two of the greatest motorsport spectacles on the planet happen at the same weekend. And I think there was a clear winner. But what does Neil Clifford think?
Well, I enjoyed both. I mean, let's kick this off with a bit of optimism. It was they were both good, weren't they?
And I was eventually
they were sandwiched between trying to watch the end of the Premier League as well for me. So I missed the start of Indy. But to be honest, the best thing about that weekend was the quali. You know, the cars are too bloody big to race around that fucking circuit, aren't they? It's like watching bumper cars. But the quali, I have to admit that Max is just brilliant, right? You know, there's no way I thought he was going to get back in that sector three. And he did. But it was like an out-of-body experience. It was like watching Senna in, Manish will tell me the day, but 93 or whenever it was, that sort of genius lap or the Donington thing. It was one of those laps that, or quali sessions that will go down in history, I think, won't it? I still feel sorry for Ferrari. They've got two of them. They've got wrong drivers, haven't they? Not good enough. Keep making mistakes.
Did you see the overlay of Alonso and Verstappen's? Yeah. It was really, really interesting to watch.
A lot of Rascas, basically.
Yeah, amazing. And you could see it, couldn't you? Not as if I'm technically brilliant, as we know, on going around tracks, but you could see that last sector, those last couple of corners, he was just on the absolute, beyond the limit, probably. He was on 110%, wasn't he?
But Alonso was well ahead of him in the first two sections.
Yeah. So I think the race was a bit tricky. I know Bernie pressed the rain button, didn't he, from up in heaven to make it a bit more interesting at the end. I know he's not dead, obviously, but he pressed it from somewhere that meant that we stayed engaged for the last third of the race. And good on Alonso, good on Lewis, I thought. There was a lot of good driving. You guys will tell me more of the technical elements of that. But I enjoyed both. I'll let Chris talk about Indy 500. But God, there's a lot of crashes and they go really fast. And aren't the cars ugly?
Right, Chris Cooper, pick up those bits and make something of them.
Yeah, so Monaco showed us that races that start dry and go wet are much more interesting than races that start wet and are wet the whole way through or just dry out, because you never quite know when. And particularly in that track, in those conditions, when they did, and, you know, poor old George, he literally was kicking himself. He had a nailed-on podium there and just got distracted by Lance disappearing up the escape road at Mirabeau, or the Rosberg Road, as we should call it, after that incident a few years ago. Qualifying was amazing. I mean, it does show, I mean, we said it when we were talking about Miami and the fuss of all the razzmatazz. They are gladiators. They are absolute heroes. There was a couple of interviews I saw on social media with Lando when he was trying to explain to people, and he just gave up. He said, I can't explain. There's nothing I can do to tell you how extraordinarily difficult that is and how much you're concentrating. And you know, we've said this before, you know, Monkey, neither you or I are in their class. We might like to think on our day of days, we were pretty bloody impressive. And we know, I mean, I think you and I are both the same. I love driving in the wet. I always love driving in the wet because everybody finds it slightly nerve-wracking and all, I can't go too fast. There's a quite technical, I won't go into it now, but there's quite technical reasons why if you push the car too much in the dry, the mu, the coefficient of friction of the surface, bring the car back. In the wet, even when it's quite damp, it's like skimming a stone. The tire lifts off the track and just skims on that bit of moisture, and it takes forever. Like a skimming stone, looks like it. Why is it still on the surface of the water when it's going quite slowly? Driving in the wet's like that. If you lose it in the wet, you've lost it. You're never going to get it back. So those guys are just heroes. The race was pretty dull. I mean, I was, as you can probably tell from my, I was actually sailing on Sunday afternoon. So I was following the race from comments from my colleagues, and I could tell it was quite dull until it started to rain. And then we just saw heroes. And it was did Aston Martin cock it up a bit? I don't know, with their strategy. But yeah, amazing. Alonso, I think I sent to you guys, there's a picture somewhere on social media I've seen of the podium. And Fernando allows the team manager of Red Bull to share his podium at third spot. So he's forced a little bit towards podium. So probably innocuously, he had 1 foot on the top step of the podium. And I thought, that's just brilliant. Fernando is driving. He's the driver of the season for me so far. Just there's a little interview I saw with him and Max talking about flowers and gardening. And you just think he's a different person. Maybe it comes to all of us. Monkey, even you, when we all grow up, will become happy and smiley and so forth. Indy was amazing. I mean, we all kept our fingers crossed when that wheel disappeared into the crowd.
Oh my God, crikey.
What happened? What happened to the wheel? I saw the incident.
It cleared a grandstand.
Fractionally, so, by the
way. Yeah,
I mean, it hit someone's car? They basically dragged her in and they fixed her car for her.
Yeah. I mean, I thought the car would have been flattened. There's a lot of energy in a flying wheel. I've been at a racing circuit and racing in an event where wheels come off a car and gone into the crowd and it doesn't end well. It's really, really horrible. So I think that was, but it just showed that you kind of got to watch a whole race because it's a bit like a mini series. You kind of, if you don't even watch the last lap, you think, wow, this is amazing. If you watch the whole race and see the build up, and people's fortunes change and ebb and flow in that race. It's such a race for doing that. And on that last one lap green flag, just amazing. Unbelievable. And Marcus Ericsson driving almost in, or is it the guy who won?
Joseph Neugarten.
Neugarten, who'd been trying for 13 years. On that last lap, basically driving into the pit road to try and break the toe. I mean, we've all seen that. So, yeah, so I think...
Are you allowed to do that?
I suspect it wouldn't be recommended again because he got very close to that divider.
I think thing about that race is you can kind of do what you want. It looks like
you can.
So
I think Monaco will always be part of F1. If it rains later in the race, same thing happened in '96, I think, when
Panis
won. unfancied way. Damon chucked it off amongst a whole bunch of others. So I think F1 survived Monaco, particularly because it was wet. The first bit of the race was rubbish. Mm-hmm. Qualifying was great. Indy is always fantastic. And the cars do look a bit shit, but it doesn't spoil that unbelievable spectacle. I thought both were really, really great in the end. And we're just so glad that everyone walked away from both of those intact. But yeah, it was a mega weekend for both of those disciplines.
Ed would love it. Thoughts?
I think you lot are far better to comment on this, but for me, it's Formula One. Just add rain.
Yeah.
Makes all the difference. And that, like, you guys are going to talk about Ocon, I'm sure, but you know, the the standard of the driving was exceptional this weekend. You know, there was obviously a little bit of twatting of the barriers at one point, but they all drove so well considering the conditions, the sizes of the car. It was very impressive to watch.
It reminds me, I shared this car, I mean, my monkey made a point yesterday there, and I said it earlier, they are all heroes and gladiators, so it's quite hard for us to sound negative about any of them because we'd just be off, and just seeing how slippery it was when they first went onto Inters. But the Autosport magazine driver rating, they described Perez's weekend as one of pure putrefaction, which I think I've never heard that word used.
I'm not in a driving context.
It's not fair. You can sit in your armchair and you can say
exactly
for a bad weekend.
But I thought it was harsh.
When you've been White City karting twice in your life, fuck off. Right, off you go, Manish, please.
Oh, gosh. You sent a little WhatsApp, which I really reflected on all yesterday evening. You were talking about the fact that had Max Verstappen been driving 30 years ago or 25 years ago, the number of little kisses he had with barriers would probably have ended his race several times. And I really thought about that. Like, for me, the drivers of this race were actually Alonso and Ocon. And what Alonso showed for me is what I would call a Senna-like precision. He wasn't overdriving the car. I think Max maybe he did get a little bit lucky because he was clouting those things all the time. And if you did watch that fantastic overlay of Alonso versus Max Verstappen, I know Max really pulled it out in the third sector, but by definition, Alonso pulled it out in sectors one and two in an Aston Martin in its first competitive year. And his driving for me this year is an absolute revelation. If you read Alonso's own criticisms of his own driving historically, what he says is he's as good as anyone in the race. You know, he's like Senna in the race. He's like Schumacher in the race. But what he said is that the chink in his armor has always been one lap qualifying. That's always been for him the little chink in his armor. And I think the lap he put together was just, it was just sort of inch perfect. It made me think, I've been thinking Max's acrobatics are quite Senna-like in a way. But for me, the lack of precision, I mean, a guy doesn't win Monaco six times in 10 races. He was on the podium twice more. I'm talking about Senna now. Should have won actually a seventh, but you know, he threw it away in 1988. If he isn't anything other than utterly precise. And for me, Max is actually Mansell. He's not Senna. He's Mansell. He's that guy with 31 wins and 31 crashes. What you see is that absolute limit, and he does veer over the top. And I mean, the other thing I would say about this race was I was wondering whether Perez was paid to crash the car. So that, because this is one of those few circuits where a crane lifts you up and everyone can see the underside. Mm-hmm. And so now everyone's copying the wrong underside in Formula One. They're all shooting away. And Adrian Newey's going, see, occasionally you have to give one away to win the whole season. So next week, okay, watch the next iteration of these cars. I mean, watch them all suddenly losing loads of time and not being able to work out why.
Yes.
Having copied the Red Bull.
That's a good
job. Very Formula One to do that. One of the few circuits we've got very high cranes. You're not just going to get wheeled off by...
I feel duty-bound to defend Arnoidge after the suggestion he had as many crashes as... And his crashes were spectacular.
Not my phrase. 31 crashes, 31... race
he's quite a big bloke, Manish.
But apparently he's very sedate now.
I'm just saying.
He's a strong boy.
Yeah.
I love the idea that they've deliberately given Perez's car a hooky underfloor. So I love that.
Yes,
Formula One. That reminds me of when I discovered, when we were researching the Lotus 79 to do a film on Top Gear, and they were trying to hide the ground effect. And Colin Chapman decided that he could dupe the rest of the teams by keeping the skirts up, and they'd all think it was a special diff he'd fitted. So after every session, he'd have someone scuttle out the back of the garage carrying something that was diff-shaped underneath a towel. And it turned out it was a massive teapot. It was just a teapot under a towel, and everyone thought it was a diff. And this one mechanic who's still alive was charged. Right, there's your teapot, put the towel over it, scuttle over there looking guilty. And that's what his job was.
Wow.
You know, Gordon Murray did exactly the same thing with his hydropneumatic Brabham when they created the, you know, 1981 yeah. little cheaty Brabham that would sink and then rise up. Yeah. He had had them just wire up a few random wires underneath, make sure that people were taking lots of photos. And this is part of Formula One, and it wouldn't surprise me.
Enough. The greatest book that's not been written is All the Cheats in Formula One. One day we'll get it written, but I just don't know who's going to give us all the info. Thoughts on the race? I think you can't undo or deny Max's brilliance. That sector three is the shortest sector of the lap, and the difference he made was outrageous. But it was almost a metaphor for his driving, that those, what, probably less than a mile of track, he managed to pull 0.3 out of everyone else on the circuit, which is outrageous and unheard of in that time. But he also managed to hit the barrier pretty much in a straight line and get away with it. And maybe we're seeing this always seems to be a correlation between the drivers that are on a high that are just riding the crest, and they have this luck, they have this Midas touch, that when they do something that anyone else does, they get away with it, but everyone else gets punished. And Max he clattered quite a few things over the weekend. Maybe he just knows. Maybe AJIM's told him, this thing's a tank. You can whack it. You can brush the wall like this, get away with it. Maybe he knows that. Sometimes it does look like he's driving with that knowledge. But he's clearly got speed in that package that no one else has got. I thought Fernando was just utterly majestic. I thought Lewis deserves some credit. I thought also Ocon was amazing. But the flip side is that when the rain came down in those cars, they're on slicks. I think everyone needs to understand how difficult that is. It's just the driving position as well. You can't see anything. They can barely see their own mirrors. They can hardly see their own front wheels. They are sitting in the gizzards of those cars with so little visibility. I mean, for George Russell to have to reverse out of that escape road and rejoin the circuit, if I'd been reversing that thing, I'd have gone straight into the barrier.
Yeah, I've seen you do that.
I think you need to keep your tools right inside your toolbox at the moment, Mr. C, because we've got a lot of gun on you. Also, you weren't sailing this weekend. You were driving your motorboat. So let's not pretend that you're from Howard's Way. So I just think that they all deserve enormous credit. But as a spectacle, if you're relying on rain in the last 10 laps, you're a bit doomed in the future. The circuit is too small for the cars. Why can't, given they build this circuit, why can't they make it longer? I mean, there's lots of other roads in Monaco. Let's rejig the track. Let's make it longer. Let's have a DRS zone that works. Let's allow them to try and overtake.
Did you like the new camera angles? Because I think qualifying, part of the reason why qualifying was such a success was because you finally got an absolute sense of speed.
That's a good spot.
I think
a big deal.
But I thought some of the direction in the race was poor because we missed.
I agree.
Key bits of racing, but the Indy, God blimey! I mean, it's not for me necessarily, but as a racing spectacle, I want to go and see that now.
Yeah, I
just
do.
Thought it was. I just thought it was raw. I thought it was good tempered. I thought it was.
Sporty. It has to be.
Yeah,
good tempered. It just can't not be.
It's 1960s Formula One, isn't it? I mean, they are so close. They are so in danger of throwing themselves into something.
I love the finish. I love Marcus Ericsson. I mean, I reckon he was turning pretty much as sharply as a car at that speed can turn. He was putting as much angle into the steering as you could without making the car do something awful.
Yeah.
I saw Catherine Legg fail to get out of the pits. And there was everything. You know, there was, you know, she didn't even put it in the wall, in the pit lane.
Pulau Vijay crash in the pit. You know, we always see unsafe releases in Formula One and they just smash into each other.
Yeah, they'd be busy. If they applied the stewards would be busy in Indy if they applied that principle.
Did you also see the tyre, the front, there was a front tyre that just sort of, someone missed. He was taking a tyre off.
That's right.
He missed it, grabbed it behind him. It was well over the line. I mean, it's just...
Yeah. If I make a simple observation, it's that it feels to me that Indy, despite the fact it doesn't have the global platform, is comfortable in itself in what it offers as a sport. I just got the feeling that when you tuned in to watch Indy, all it wanted to give you was racing drivers in cars doing their thing. When I tuned into F1, I got the sense that there was a sport that was trying to justify itself, that was trying to big itself up, and it had so much peripheral stuff going on. You know, I don't really care about rap artists and everything else. I know that the sport wants that. But for me, that's just a sign that you're trying a bit harder to market yourself. Whereas if you, you know, if you're a great chef, you just hand over great food and people eat it and enjoy it. But if you're a bit worried about what you're trying to serve, you probably give us every single thing written down on the menu as a description. Indy just seems a bit more comfortable with itself to me. That's my observation. And I'm very much a European racer. So I'd be interested to see what happens.
Do you see the guy, Martin Brundle, on his pit walk again, trying to get to Horner?
Yeah.
I'll get fucking bolloped.
Yeah. Well, yeah. It's almost like that was set up for me. Right.
I think we need a trip to Indy.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. God, blimey. Gene Shepherd, trip to Indy. Get that story and read it. Now, the shortest time you've ever owned a car. I'm not sure we can ask this to Edward Lovett because he's a motor trader with his glasses guide in his back pocket. So I'm going to ask this one to Chris Cooper.
So this is a bit embarrassing because we've talked about how much we love Alpina. And the shortest time I've owned a car was an Alpina. And it's a really nerdy, irritating, embarrassing reason. It was a BE46 B3.3 about 20 years ago. And I'd had a BMW 540 before that, which had loads of torque, had beautiful waftability. And I thought B3.3 is going to be even sharper, really nice. And it was really disappointing straight after the 540. And the reason was, in those Steptronic BMW boxes, if you move the gear lever just to the left, it automatically knocked it down a gear. So it gave you a little bit of instant extra torque by knocking it just to the left. The Alpina version of the Steptronic gearbox didn't do that. And irritatingly, when you did it, it sort of, when you knocked it to the left, it sort of went, the little thing on the dashboard just briefly flash up S, thinking, oh, it's going to knock it down a gear, but it went straight to manual. So you had to knock it to the left and then use the buttons. So it just, for me, because I'm really nerdy, thought, doesn't quite work right. And I had a long conversation with the dealership, Sittner's in, would have been Gerrard's Cross at the time, before it went to High Wycombe. And I said, there must be a reason, there must be a way of fixing this. And they said, no. So because of the way the gearbox, when you knocked the lever to the left, didn't go down a gear, and just the way I'd used to drive the car, I thought, it's really irritating. I was reminded of this by somebody who, because I mentioned Sittner and my B3 Touring, the single one that was sold in the UK, one of the Sittner guys got in touch with me and said, do you remember the previous one you had? And you had that really irritating fault you couldn't fix with the gearbox. I thought, oh God, that's really irritating. So I owned it for about 2 weeks, 3 weeks.
Oh.
And I just couldn't live with that. Now I'm really, really regretting it because it's a lovely car. And I'd have one again in a flash. Now I know what I'm doing and I'm not such an idiot. But that shortest time I've ever owned a car was about 3 weeks because of the really irritating and nerdy view I had as to how I wanted the gearbox to work when you knocked it from the right to the left.
Can I just stop me there for a second? Because actually, in 20 weeks of bearing our souls and how sad we are, that is a new depth.
It's quite low.
I have never heard anything like that in my life. I applaud you for sharing that with our audience.
It's quite low.
And I'll give you the number of my therapist later on because that requires help.
How much of your money do you get back when you go back with a car 3 weeks later? Do they say, nah, no?
We've already answered that question.
We're in a different time now.
I'm not going to answer that question because I've already embarrassed myself.
Well, done the biggest appreciation about
that one before. It wasn't quite as bad.
Neil Clifford's got his 1,000-yard stare on at the moment because he's deciding which one of his shit fights he wants to tell us about. So, Neil, over to you.
I'm referring to a new car purchase, actually. I'm sure there's other stories that I can sort of dig out of the back of my head where I've hidden them under the bed. But the new car...
You're not a flipper, are you, Neil? You're not a flipper.
I'm not a flipper. I'm a very famous non-flipper, as you will know it. But I did the Taycan. It was a really right brain versus left brain decision, the Taycan, because there was all the logic, all the left brain was telling me, oh, this is going to be great for your daily commute, and it's going to be free for the congestion charge, and you can charge it at work and charge it at home. And wouldn't it be very sensible to get a take-out? You'll save a lot of money. And the right brain was telling me, don't be a fucking idiot. Don't give up. The one thing that you enjoy, which is the car with an engine, don't give up that, because you don't really drink, you don't really do smoke, you don't do lots of other shit. You work and you drive cars and you have a family and a pretty boring chap. So anyway, my left brain won, and it was the stupidest decision I've ever made. I had it for three and a half weeks, paid 105 grand for it. Actually, I was very sensible on the spec. I knew in a way I was doing the wrong thing. You know when you're doing something?
Yeah, that's the mistake.
You know you'd like, this is going to be wrong. Why are you buying this bloody thing? So I went silver. I did go full chocolate leather, but I kept the spec. It was the 4S, not the 10.
Yeah, that's a mistake.
I didn't get out of control. Anyway, I then almost forced myself into a position of hating it. I think I almost did it subconsciously, deliberately. I thought, oh, I'm going to go to Liverpool for the day on my son's birthday, because I've got to visit this store, I've got to do work. There's no other car that I can take apart from the Taycan. Clearly there was.
Yeah.
And off I went, and it was the biggest disaster. I was stuck in Liverpool. There were no chargers. I then ended up in Cheshire, I think, at some shitty petrol station for 3 hours. I got home 4 hours late. I was in the shit at home. And I sold it back, lost, I think, 8 grand. Actually, the car would probably be worth more now than it was then.
Not now.
But yeah, 3.5 weeks, Porsche Taycan. Never let your left brain make decisions. That's the omen.
So we've gone from sort of therapy to almost sort of Bible studies. I mean, that was almost like a parable, Neil. And I expect you to... to talk about him have long hair or something afterwards. Now, here we go, Manish. What's the shortest time you've owned a car? From what I've gathered, you've only ever owned about three.
One. I've literally only ever owned one car. So it's actually the longest I've owned it. You know all about this car. I was standing at the Vista station, as you know, surrounded by. I bought the car.
He's still got
not that bloody car again.
We can move to an advertising break now.
Shall I tell you, I did have a bad night's sleep over this last night, because the problem with this show is that actually you can only bullshit for a certain number of weeks, right? Everyone susses who you really are, as opposed to you think you're coming across as, you know, all your facial tics, all your psychological. Anyway, the reason why I didn't sleep last night wasn't this question. What it was I was just wondering whether we'd have this again in about 6 months, where actually the question would be, how long did Manish keep his 456? I am so nervous about this now.
You're right to be. You're right to be.
It's like the ultimate Venn diagrams of cars, and I can just see I do it. And suddenly go, no, no, no.
He should have bought an FF.
What I'm going to do now is I'm going to move on to Edward Lovett, okay? Then we're going to come back to you and ask you, I'm going to ask you a different question, maybe about tea or something. Now, Edward Lovett, what's the shortest time you've owned a car which you paid for with someone else's money?
So I sell cars in an instant, so not, it doesn't take me very long to do it when I was a car dealer. But I'll tell you a good story, which I quite like. And actually, the guy I bought it off has recently passed away. So, and I'm pretty sure he hated me because I did this. But anyway, I was at Pebble Beach about 5 or 6 years ago, and on the Tuesday in California, they do the concourse on the avenue, where a lot of the the main concourse, there's some lovely cars parked there. Anyway, so I saw these guys in the street, and as you do with car dealers, how are you? How's business? Nice weather, isn't it? Got anything interesting for sale? Bit of small talk. And they go, yeah, we just bought this little collection of cars. And so they gave me a list of it, and a list of the cars they'd bought. And there were two cars on there that I quite liked. And I said, can I see some photos of them? And I said, well, let's go back to the hotel room. I'll show you the photos. So we did that, went back to the hotel room. and I agreed, subject to seeing
I agreed,
subject to seeing them after Pebble Beach, that I would buy these two cars. So anyway, Pebble Beach goes, fly back to London, and I had to move house in London. So literally flew back, moved house, hopped on a plane, went to straight back to Boston 24 hours later, drove to see these two cars, one of which was a 250 PF coupe, and very happy with the car. And I stayed the night before, and then I was flying back that evening. So I thought, I'm sure there's a car dealer on the other side of Boston that I know. So I drove the other side of Boston, met this guy, lovely car dealer, Copley Motor Company. Stu Carpenter. How are you? Nice weather. How's the market? How's business? What got any cars for sale? I think he asked me this time and goes, yeah, I've actually just bought a 250 PF coupe. And anyway, 30 seconds later, I agreed to sell him the car. Didn't think anything of it. Flew back to London. And obviously, you know, these dealers didn't, they never offered him the car in Boston. The two dealers on the other side of Boston, me, bloke from Swindon. And then I drove across town, sold in the car. I don't think they ever forgave me for it.
I'm amazed by that. What, I mean, how
selfish? Well, it's just sometimes with deals, it's about right time, right place. And I was in the right time, and I was stood opposite them, and they'd just been offered it, and I agreed to buy it there and then. And, you know, your words, your bond and all that, and got on, did the deal. Anyway, that was the best, shortest time I've owned a car for. And we're not flippers here, so I've got so many stories of people that flip cars. So
there are other stories where you did flip it.
No, I'm a car dealer, so I'm allowed to
flipping
flip
cars, but at Silverstone, I think he's referring to.
Yeah.
But Chris, just what one story you told me of, who this was a Dick Lovett customer, and this is a pretty well-to-do banker in London, and he said, he called you and said, where am I? And he goes, I'm on the way. I've sold the KN for 1,500 quid profit or something.
It's genius. I love this man, but he basically phoned me and he said, yeah, I'm just on my way down. I've just got a Cayenne diesel out of Bristol, flipped it. He'd made like $4,000. He basically made what he'd make in 10 minutes if he'd been sitting at his desk in London. But it was the middle of that era when everyone was just so addicted to being a car trader. That's when it all
they love it.
When everyone thought they'd become a motor trader. And they would, and you, this is the thing about, this is the thing I love about. This is the meritocracy of the marketplace, is that if you're offered the chance to buy a car, no matter what someone tells you to do, what piece of paper you're told to sign, it's yours. You've bought it. You can do what you want with it. You can crush it. You can race it. Do what you want. But if you want to give it to the next man for a little tickle, you can do that as well. Just don't expect to get another one. And I think those stories, I don't have any great stories about owning cars a short time necessarily. I know that I've been accused of flipping cars in the past. There's my 992 GT3 Touring is currently for sale at some Porsche dealership. And I keep getting people forwarding me pictures of it with hashtag flipper. It's done 7,500 miles, half of them sideways. I just don't understand. Don't understand how that constitutes flipping. I thought flipping is when you leave something in the garage and don't use it. And then you, anyhow, I do think that I had a couple.
Do you think it's helping them that they're advertising it at 20 grand more than it's sold for and collecting cars?
It's probably not helping them too much. My name on the V5 never helps. But I do think that I've had a couple. I had a Peugeot 106 XSI back in the day. I had two of them. The second one, I had one and thought it was not as good as a 205 XS. And I remember sticking with it because it looked cool and it was such a, it had the sort of more sporty stuff on it, the extended wheel arches and everything. And I just thought it convinced myself it was great and it wasn't. So I bought another one and I think I had it a day and I tried to sell it back to the same bloke and he didn't want anything to do with it. So that was an awful experience. I think once you've gone back, Neil Clifford knows this, once you've gone back, you've convinced yourself there's going to be a different outcome, that could be applied to other areas of life. You can
it's dreadfully disappointing when you think, why have I done this? That is left brain versus right brain. You're right. But I think the most disappointing new car I've ever bought was that 997 Carrera 2 that I bought. It was a Carrera 2S, talked about on here before. I don't think I owned it very long at all. I just think I bought the thing, thought this is just not what I expected at all, and got rid of it as soon as possible and took some huge amount of depreciation. I think I lost £8,000 or £10,000 in a couple of months when I really couldn't afford to do so. But yeah, I'm trying to think of an ownership experience that was short but positive. In other words, how many people own a car but they have to get rid of it rather than they decide to get rid of it? Those are the stories we need to unearth. In fact, if you're in the comments section, please tell us those stories. I'm not saying any in this group, but just that shattering moment where you've got to get rid of something. You think it's landed, I love this. And then the school fees come in, or the revenue wants some money off you, or everything goes tits up, or your business goes under. Those would be the shattering ones. I'm lucky I've not had one of those with a new car. I've had it with old cars. Okay, now, this is a random one. I've asked each of our contributors to regurgitate their favourite motoring phrase and what it means to them. I've got a couple. I'm going to start off this one, okay, because I'm still talking. I've got two.
You can start it. You might be finishing it as well.
I know. Well, I've got two. The first was, I think, the first time I heard Martin Brundle use the phrase mobile chicane to describe a back marker. I'd never heard it before, but I think in terms of phrases that just describe something in a way that you never thought of talking about it, it was such a perfect and remains a phrase that I think so many people have adopted, but he was the first person to do it.
I don't think so. Do you know? I think it was actually Alan Jones describing the 1981 Ferrari. I think it was him. Yeah, I think so. I think he said that we had to go past the mobile chicane.
You're right.
It was Jonesy, actually.
I've never heard it in a commentating capacity, so I'm going to give it to Martin because he was brave enough to say it from the comms box. I love that. And I've got another one for you, which was my late dear mother. This describes how different we are, how differently we react to fast-moving cars now. I think that if you're going quite quickly on a motorway or an A road now and something comes past you, people tend to react in a negative fashion. There's this absurd sense that even though you're probably breaking the speed limit yourself, you have the moral superiority because that person's going even faster. That you become the arbiter of what sensible speed is because you appointed yourself as some kind of justice system, which is fucking absurd, let's face it. Sorry, pound in the box for Chris Cooper. Anyhow, I love the fact that now in the old days, my mother would be tanking along and we'd get something would come screaming past, normally a bike, and she'd go, "He's going well." I just love that phrase. And I try to say it myself now with the kids in the car. If something comes past me, it's rare, but they do now and again, I always go, "He's going well," or "She's going well." Yeah, I just think it's a nice way of approaching the subject. And the reason why it means something to me is my old dear used to say it. There we go. I'm now probably, that was very much designed for me, that question. I wonder if the rest of you managed to find anything else in it. Neil Clifford.
I did. And I don't know whether this is really a motoring phrase, but anyway, I spent a lot of money on booze, women, and fast cars. The rest I just squandered. and this is officially my man crush, which is George Best.
Yeah.
Oh, brilliant.
The best British footballer of all time. For me, the most beautiful man of all time. If your man crush, Chris, is Toto, mine is George Best, without doubt. Amazing movies to watch about him, but you know, the most talented guy. I had the kit, I had the football boots, I even did the celebration. You know, I'm a man of the 70s, and he scored with left foot, right foot, the head. He won the European Championship for Man United. I am a Red, I inherited that from my brother. But you know, and then he had Jags, didn't he? If you Google him, he had E-types, he had Mark I Jags, he had Astons, he had Lotus, you know, he had a couple of cool Lotuses. But I think actually I reflected on it and tried to be a little bit sort of grown up and sensible just for 1 minute. He's telling us a lot, I think, with that statement, because he's telling us to go and fucking enjoy life. You know, it isn't a drill. It's not a rehearsal, you know. laugh a lot, do as much as you can. You know, COVID really was shit for us all, wasn't it? It was certainly shit for me from a business perspective, work perspective. I spent 6 months on the sofa, you know, getting up at one in the morning. And I think post-COVID.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
I really made a determined, clear decision to have a bit more joy, have a bit more fun. I think it interrupted our rhythms badly, but I think make a firm decision to have more pleasure, meet new people, travel more, see the world, do stupid shit. I think that whole reference of don't grow up, you know, it's a trap, I think is dead right. Don't stop learning. The most important thing for me post-COVID is maintain curiosity, right? Our mental health, I'm going really deep now, but our mental health, you know, it's a good thing we talk about mental health now, because just because you've got loads of flash cars and you've got a nice house, you haven't got a mortgage, it doesn't really fucking matter at the end of the day. You can still be sort of super low. And I think out of COVID, I decided to really get going. Be curious. Pretend you're still 12 years old. I think it's a big lesson. And that's what George was telling us. Don't grow up. So that's my little rant for the day.
Curiosity. Also, get invited onto a random podcast.
Well, you know what? I was thinking that, Chris. I would have 100% said no, right? If Ed would have asked me pre-COVID, oh, I can't do that. I'm too busy. I've got this big job. I don't want to mix, you know, chips with pasta. I don't want to mix up. I don't want to expose, you know, I don't want to look a bit of an idiot on a podcast. I can't do that. I'm going to be sensible. What are people going to think? You know what? Fuck it. Right? Enjoy yourself, because at some point you're going to be in a wheelchair pissing in your trousers, right? And it's not going to be that long. So I think be curious and meet new people and get yourself out of your comfort zone as much as possible. And that's my reflection of me doing this podcast in a way. And we should all go out there and pretend we're 12. That's what George was telling me.
Can I have your speedster when you're pissing in your trousers?
You can, yeah. It's 500
Cheers,
grand.
Thanks.
500 grand. Well, Edward, I tell you what, Edward, he's undone you there, because he's saying go out and be 12. Well, as far as I'm concerned, you've never grown up beyond 12. So what are your favourite words?
Well, I wrote some down and I couldn't think of anything smart, Chris, but listening to your story, it's just reminded me of one. And my godfather was Tom Walkinshaw. And I, Tom owned Gloucester Rugby Club, and his funeral was in Gloucester, and Martin Brundle was there, and he stood up and did an eulogy, and I'm going to butcher this a bit, but I'll do my best. But he was telling a story of when they were racing at Bathurst. And Martin said, I've never raced here before, Tom. You know what they were. So they were both in TWR Jaguars. And Martin said, I've never raced here. How do we do this? And Tom was, when the cat wags its tail, just follow it. And it just resonated with me. And I And there we go. There's one. It came to me from yours, Chris. But I had some other ones written down, but that's better than all of them.
Tom Walkinshaw's Cheat Stories. That's half that book. Manish, yeah. Half that book.
Yeah.
Manish, you've probably got a few words that you can mention here.
Yeah, you know, I'm listening to Neil. I want to actually just change something I've written. Stenner was always regarded as a little bit, you know, maybe a little bit dour, especially by the British media. But like Brazilians, he had a lot of difficulty with consonants. You know, they all speak very nasally. They don't hit hard T's and D's. And there was when he really felt he'd done something very well, I always remember this phrase he had. My friend Max from school and I always used it to describe when something went incredibly right, whether it was an exam or a girl or a party, we'd say, tremendios fantas. And that's what he would say. He couldn't say tremendously fantastic, which is just wonderful. You know, too superb, tremendios fantas. Tremendous fantas. This Grand Prix is tremendous fantas. The overtaking is tremendous fantas. So lovely. I just love that. It's so positive.
Edward, that is our first t-shirt for this podcast, all right? That is our first t-shirt.
Is it?
Tremendous fantas.
We're going into the swag business. Tremendous fantas. Love it. Right. Chris Cooper.
So, places to be. So whenever Monkey's right. Whenever occasionally people do get past me on the public highway, and I'm very gracious about it. And both Finn and Cameron both said on occasion when somebody's gone, Harry Flatters passes, another great expression. I was trying to discover the etymology of Harry Flatters this morning. And it's quite opaque. But when somebody goes, Harry Flatters past you, rather than chase him, Dad, which I never need encouragement for, they'll say places to be. He's got places to be. She's got places to be, which I think is a great British understatement for, he's going well.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. They're a bit with your mum on that one, Monkey. But my kind of, I thought about, sorry, everybody else. I thought about one of my favourite phrases for a long time was, it's funnier in the front. And I thought and that's just going to mean something to Monkey from all of our trips. When the three of us used to drive to Germany, and Guy Spur, now a coffee merchant and roaster in Sussex, I spoke to last week, and reminded me about this.
Cast Iron Roasters is a plug for his business. Go and look at some coffee; it's fantastic.
And it is very good.
He's a great man.
He said, you must find a way somehow of wheedling in. It's funnier in the front. Because the three of us just travel together, and Monkey would always sit in the back, and he would always try and claim it's funny in the back. And we said, no, it's always funny in the front. But the one I kind of like most is give it the berries, which is, you could probably guess it could only have come from Nigel Mansell.
Oh.
And he would occasionally, Nigel was a hero of mine. I guess because he's British, and because he never looked like anybody's idea, really, of a racing guy. He didn't look like a sort of a raffish Graham Hill or the people that came before him. Nor is he, didn't. And he was the antithesis of Nelson Piquet.
But it's really funny you say that. I think he looks like a fighter pilot. He looks like a fighter pilot.
World War II.
I could imagine him in his greens. He's got the mustache, even the flag. He just looks, he has a kind of coolness about him.
And I think he's got that. Cool, he's got that. And that, just that wonderfully, because let's face it, he was known and he is known for how he'd react to some of his crashes and sort of rather overdoing, it was really painful, Murray, and so forth. But this sort of wonderfully understated, give it the berries. In other words, just give it all the throttle and just give it death. And there were times when, and Patrick Head would always say about him, when he was in the car, you knew that's how fast that car would go. He simply couldn't help himself. He just had to drive it. And that fantastic 92 car, where he qualified at Silverstone in the 92 British Grand Prix, 1.7, 1.8 seconds on pole from Patrese, he was quite a good peddler. But Patrese just didn't have the nerve or the berries to do that high-speed turning where on that active ride, the car just had a little bit of a shimmy. And Nigel just said, we're going for it. So give it the berries. Sums up my hero, Nigel, really well.
Love it. Right. Now, we're moving on to our two-car garage for the week, which is set by and is therefore absolutely absurd. Here we go. And I can't believe I'm reading this. So just imagine that it's not me. You are a wealthy Arab sheikh, I wish, spending time between the Middle East and London. It's a funny old time since the oil crisis. You are wealthier than ever, but not perhaps as popular as you once were, as Britain is enduring a pretty nasty recession. So your London car is all about being seen as serious and sensitive, brackets, while still maintaining a certain level of decorum befitting your status, dash, i.e. you can't be seen in a 2CV. I'll take issue with that later on, Manish. Whilst at home, you're going to burn it in whatever you want. Manish, answer your own question first, please.
Chris, I think you missed the start of it. It's 1977.
1977, sorry.
That's quite important.
1977.
Yeah. Yeah, now you've offended everyone because you didn't put that one in at the start.
Well, it's 1977, and you've got that. 77, rich Arab between Middle East and London, sensible town car, fancy one back at home. Let's go.
Manish.
So we've talked about this car in the context of the police, but I think he's going to get himself a Rover 3500 SD1 with a chauffeur in the front. I think lots and lots of cloth. I think this is going to be navy blue. I think you're not going to see it. He's going to have a chauffeur, and the chauffeur's going to be... Do you remember that show, Butterflies?
Yes.
Oh, lovely.
Wendy Craig.
Exactly. Wendy Craig. Who was the guy who was desperately in love with her and had a Ford Granada with a chauffeur?
Wow, that's good.
Yeah, no, that's true. I don't remember.
No, because that was the point. You know, she was desperately. Right. She was this kind of fun... She was married to Jeffrey... What's his name?
Jeffrey Palmer.
Jeffrey Palmer,
the dentist. I'm on the Google.
I think he was one of my uncles.
But it had one of the best visual jokes.
Meet your new uncle.
I just remember it had the best visual joke I've ever seen, because Nicholas Lindhurst was one of her kids.
And it was the weedy one, yeah.
Yes, and there was a running joke that she couldn't cook, so she has a go at frying some onions, and he lifts this up, and he says, "Mum, your cooking looks like some form of contraceptive." It's just this onion ring, which has been deep fried. It was
she was lovely.
Oh, Rhea. So,
okay.
I imagined that it was a toss-up between a Granada with a chauffeur and the Rover SD1. And I did a little bit of looking. And do you know, there's the promotional film for the Rover 3500 was actually made by Raymond Baxter. It's 10 minutes long.
God.
And Sir he talks Raymond about Baxter. David Bash, the guy who designed it,
yeah.
Who looks like the lollipop guy from Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. I mean, a really sinister-looking German.
Well, the child catcher.
The child catcher from Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. Have you seen Raymond? Have a look at David Bash. Check him out. Scary-looking dude.
Given recent news events, let's steer clear of child catching, please. Okay. The SD1, thank you.
But it's got this lovely section, which almost Ridley Scott could have shot. Okay, so you've got the Rover 3500. It's driving through the French countryside to Stevie Wonder's Isn't She Lovely?
Oh,
I can't believe we haven't seen that. It's fantastic. So that's his main car. And then I think back in the Middle East. You see, this guy, I think, doing a Neil, was sent to the Rosy in Stade for his schooling. A school which today costs 50,000 quid a term. Okay, so this is a very elite school. He spent lots and lots of time in Switzerland. He speaks beautiful French, reasonably good German, perfect English, and of course, six Arab dialects. He's a very refined man. And I think in 1977, his head was turned by a Monteverdi 375 SL high speed.
Oh, lovely.
Little coupe at the back. 7-litre engine. Fisore, Carrozzeria Fisore, although I think it was Fruo designed it. And this thing, I found out, was 79,200 Swiss francs in 1977. £20,000. It was more expensive than a Berlinetta Boxer at the time. And that is going to be his car at home.
You've been working on this for weeks.
Also, can we agree that Monteverdi is in the top five greatest sounding car names ever?
Yeah, I'm going to come back to that.
Whenever you race against Carlos at an old race meeting, you look at his name on the timesheets and just go, you should win. Just give you the win. Your name's too cool. Right. Neil Clifford.
Right. The obvious call is...
he got his top trunks out.
And by the way, if you're a refined gentleman of the Middle East in 1977 in London, you do not leave the square that goes from Harrods to Sloane Square, Eaton Square, Buckingham Palace, Regent Street. You're only in Kensington or Mayfair. So there's no exposure to any fucking recession whatsoever, right? You're staying in the Dorchester. You know, you're at the Playboy Club. You're in Curzon Street casinos. You are having fun. Your family has been poor for 4,000 years. You are not getting involved in any recessions. So you're ignoring any element of being subtle. You're going to buy a Rolls-Royce Camargue.
Yeah, Manish, I'm just ignoring the challenge.
He's done you there, Manish. He's taken your historical context. And he stuffed it right where the sun don't shine.
That's the Tuesday 10 o'clock fire alarm. So you're going to buy a Rolls-Royce Camargue. If anything says, I am wealthier than you in 1977, it's a Rolls-Royce Camargue. Pinifarina, beautiful thing, actually. Yeah. I don't know what. He's probably going gold with the chocolate. And he's just smoking around with a cigar. In Camargue. What is he going to do back in Riyadh? Well, actually, he's getting a Monteverdi. Mm. Monteverdi is the thing, and it's a Monteverdi High 50S. It's the one we've never seen. You can almost not even see it on YouTube. This thing is so rare. But your 7 litre, it won everything in top trumps, actually.
It did.
It was the car. It was, you know, there was the Countach, there was the Boxster, there was the Daytona, there was the 250 short wheelbase, there was the weird sort of 356s with the strange children photographs. But the Monteverdi 450S High was the car. That's what he'd have. He'd have the two best cars out of top trumps.
Or an SS?
450. S.
Right, Chris Cooper's making a note of that. He can now give us his two-car garage.
So I've given this a bit of thought. 1977. God. Interesting year. Stagflation rather than inflation. It was kind of the end of the post-war Keynesian economics phenomenon. So a bit similar to what we've got right now. So there was persistent high inflation. Inflation in 77, 15.8%. Fourth year in a row, inflation had been in double figures, but there was growth. Small, 2.5% GDP growth in 77, a bit more in 78. But it was getting towards the end of that point where post-war Keynesian economics, which was government intervention sooner rather than markets. So the point about this is, people are interested in this stuff, Chris. The point about this is...
You podcast about cars, don't you?
So the point, there's a point to this. The point about this is it was the end of one era going to another era. So Ford Fiesta was launched in 1977.
It was.
The M5 was launched, the motorway, that is, not the car. Mm. First commercial Concorde flight. That was a big milestone in 77, massive, apart from the Queen's massive. Jubilee.
Early was on that, by the way, the Air France one.
The first one, that one, they had the dual takeoff, one to Bahrain, one to wherever it went to Rio.
So it went to Rio. So you flew from Paris to somewhere in West Africa, I think Senegal, and then Senegal to Rio.
And it was that kind of Virginia Wade won Wimbledon. Best-selling single that year was Mullican Turbine Wings.
Galactic style digression. I'm loving it. Carry on.
Yeah, the chain Fleetwood Mac. That still started.
As you're still going.
Yeah. Still going. And OPEC was probably in its heyday. So OPEC was set up in 1960, and it was a response from the Middle East, our Sheikh's family included, to the Seven Sisters. The Seven Sisters were the big US oil companies. So OPEC was set in 1960, but its heyday was between the Yom Kippur Yom Kippur War of 73, the oil crisis, and the Iranian Revolution in 78, which precipitated another oil crisis. So 77 was kind of their heyday. If you look at the history of OPEC, it was absolutely, that was his heyday. So that's another way of saying Neil is right, Manish. This guy would not be being bashful because this was OPEC's heyday. So his London car.
We've just gone through musical choices, post-Keynesian economics, tectonic plates shifting politically, and the top 10. And all of that is just to say this guy doesn't give a shit.
We asked you to name two cars, and you've come up with the words Yom Kippur.
Yeah, that's it. That's why people love this stuff. So the first car would be, I think, because there's been a little bit of subtlety, but hey, this guy knows his stuff. Maserati Kyalami.
Oh, yes. Ooh.
Just love that. I'd have one now. In fact, I'm going to go and find one now. Just
buy one. Beautiful. Buy one for Manish.
Such an elegant two-door, three-box shape, four-seater, big VA engine.
Gorgeous.
I had Monteverdi High 450 on my list, but because I never just have one, I also had, if he's just going to go mad in 1977 at home, he'd have a Panther 6.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Panther 6.
It gets a second mention. It has to.
Yeah. That's the context. Some political considerations, social change. Maserati Kyalami, Panther 6.
It's like you're a mobile textbook of information, and we love it. We're very grateful for it because it also gives us a chance just to nod off whilst you're talking and just regroup. Now then, I'm going to speak next, just in case Edward Lovett's got the same choices as me, which I fear he might. So I'm going for the London car. I've adhered to what Manish has asked me to choose from because I don't have any idea of the socioeconomic times that we're dealing with, because I was only two at the time and OPEC I thought was an ice lolly. I have no idea about any of it. So I'm going to say that if I'm going to drive around London and be subtle but actually have a bit of fun, I've gone for a 450 SEL 6.9, but it's had the badges taken off it to be a 280.
Nice.
I think that's a nice way around it. So I've got basically a 6.9 litre V8 that can do 150 miles an hour, but it's badged a 280, and I've had a locking diff put in it. And therefore, I can smoke around every 90-degree turn in London and be an absolute arse. My Riyadh car is a little bit more spectacular because I've got a special relationship with Maranello that you don't know about. So I've gone there, and I've said to the commendatore, I've said, look, I've had a Daytona, but it's not enough. I want a comp. I want a Daytona comp with number plates. So he's done me a comp, best of all, because he knows me too well. He's had the passenger seat taken out of it, and he's had a little bed put in for my pet cheetah. So I've got because I'm in 77 in Riyadh, I'm going to have a pet cheetah.
You are, 100%.
I sleep with this cheetah every night. So I've got a Daytona comp for the road with number plates with a cheetah seat in it. Okay. Yes, Ed would love it. You go.
That is genius.
Ed would love it.
Well, I'm dear friends with the Ferruccio Lamborghini.
Yeah.
And I called him to tell him about my dilemma, and he said, fuck him. Don't worry. I build you a pair of cars. Exactly. I build you an LP400 Periscopio, and I build you an Espada. And we do them in the same color. Oro Metallizzato Longchamp.
Yeah.
I'll tell you what, you've absolutely smashed it. And also, historically, none of us knew that Ferruccio came from Bangladesh.
I didn't.
Fuck off. His accent, you mean?
Look at that. Look at it.
Oh, my days.
Yeah.
That's fun. Okay.
Yeah.
I think we've nailed those. Now, look, people, there was one other thing on the list, but I'm going to have to say no to it this week because we've done well over an hour, and I'm afraid, I might have mentioned this before, I'm writing a fucking book and it's not going very quickly at the moment. So I'm going to have to go off and do a bit of book writing. I think we've had a good discussion this week. So I'd like to move on, please, to some music. So Neil Clifford, can you give us a piece of music? And I know that you're in a reflective mood, so this could be quite heartfelt.
Oh, yeah, no, I'm in a deep, and maybe it's the bank holiday that's maybe all reflective and soft and squidgy. I'm staying in Britpop. I'm staying in the 90s. You mentioned it last week, Chris, and I thought, fuck yes, that's, I've done my Oasis. I'm sure I will do a Blur, but I'm going to go Verve, They were probably my second. I put them ahead of Blur, really. Pulp in fourth. I got married on September the 11th. Now, obviously, that's not a very good day for an anniversary, really. But I did get married in 1999. So it was sort of before the September 11th thing became famous. But it was my first dance song, or whatever you call it, with my wife, Lucky Man. And, it, you know, it's an emotional song for me and my wife. Fortunately, I still am with my wife, which is sort of lucky for me, frankly. But it's a brilliant song. It's all about the fact, if you study the lyrics, it's all about the fact of after the peacock moment when you're showing off as a bloke and you've impressed her and you've taken her to the right restaurants and you've shown her your best shoes or whatever you've done, that moment after that, when it becomes just normal and you can't have an act anymore, you've got to be normal. I traveled the world with my wife for 2 years and you can't hide shit in 2 years in a camper van. So Lucky Man is my choice of song today. And it is brilliant.
That album is just...
Oh, it's a brilliant album.
You could say Oasis was a better band, but I think if you looked at the best four songs on the best albums of all time made by British artists, I think Urban Hymn might be the best of those.
I think Elton John even said, I wish I would have written Lucky Man by The Verve. It's that good.
Sonnet, Drugs Don't Work.
Drugs Don't Work. The whole album.
Like a cat in a bag waiting to drown. Whenever I hear that, I go, oh my God.
Yeah.
Okay, sorry, I digress. Manish.
I'm going to go back to the 70s, 1976. Jean-Michel Jarre released the album Oxygen.
Oh,
and if you remember, Oxygen 4 was the big hit. So imagine that in your car. I listened to it last night. It absolutely stands up. And Jean-Michel Jarre, very good looking. Remember the big long hair? Mm-hmm. He was married to Charlotte Rampling. I just had this awful moment when I turned it on and watched this video. He looked a lot like Lawrence Llewellyn Bowen. That was the only sad moment. I sort of looked at it. Oh no! But he was much more talented.
Dude.
Much more talented.
You'll be saying Mozart looked like Noel Edmonds next week. Chris Cooper.
So I was just trying to find now, because I saw it in the comments from last week's episode. I know you tell us not to read the comments, but obviously all of us read all of them. It reminded me that we haven't said, and nobody said, Don Henley, Summer. Yeah, that one.
Summer.
Yeah. So that's what I think is just such an uplifting, soaring, brilliant.
Yeah, lovely song.
Edward Lovett.
I delved into a Spotify black hole this morning, trying to deal with jet lag as I'm here somewhere.
There he is.
Is that Bristol?
That's Bristol,
that,
yeah.
That is actually, yeah, that's the central Bristol overlooking Henley's there.
fighting a bit of jet lag this morning, and for some reason at 4 o'clock this morning I found myself in sort of trance nation, trying to find things that I listened to in the car as a young man, and I didn't think trance was really what we'd want to be listening to here, so I found Robert Miles, Children, and I listened to it. And that's my choice for today. It's quite good. I had some other rather bizarre ones, but that's my choice.
I'm writing that down now.
Cracking tune. Slightly dangerous given the times we're in, but I'll go with
it. Yeah. Seems to be a lot of references. Shall I edit it for another one?
A lot of references to a particular daytime TV show today. And this is a group that we've not mentioned yet, and it's easy to hate them, and it's very easy to hate the lead singer, but I was... I don't agree with either of those positions, but I was watching something on Instagram when you scroll through endlessly and you say, I'm not going to look at the next one. And it keeps going. And you've lost 20 minutes of your life and you think about it.
At least.
And there was a live version of the U2's Where the Streets Have No Name. And I just think that soaring guitar intro is pretty special. I know it's a bit of a cliche, but it's quite a tune, and I defy anyone to put it on today.
Oh, it's amazing.
Have a bit of a heart-melty moment. And it also allows you then to go back to the Alan Partridge episode where he pretends to his girlfriend that he knows Bono, and he goes to a tea shop in a stately home in Norwich and gets his mate to dress up as the Edge. And it is absolutely fine. It's absolutely fantastic, isn't it? No, he gets him to dress up as Bono, isn't he? So he
says, it's Bono, yeah.
Is the Edge. The Edge is fine. So you can laugh at that as well. But no, I think that U2 tune is fantastic. Thank you very much for being with us today. I've got one other piece of housekeeping for you. A couple of weeks ago, one of my favourite writers passed away. Not many people know who he was. It wasn't Martin Amis. It was a guy that wrote a column in The Spectator. This is apolitical. I don't like any politicians left or right. Just so happens this guy was a great writer. He was called Jeremy Clark, all right? And I implore any of you to try and get hold of this book. This was the best column written in the English language for the last 20 years. It's irreverent, it's funny, it's naughty, it's sad. It's really, really brilliant. And this podcast should serve to surface the things in our lives that we think are joyous that we want to share with you. That's the whole point of it. And that's one from me, Jeremy Clark. Go and read his columns because they are just spectacular. From Edward Lovett in Hong Kong, from Chris Cooper in King's Lynn, from Manish Pandey in Central London, and from Neil Clifford, fuck knows where he is, and from
London,
me in Bristol.
London.
London. From me in Bristol, have a lovely, lovely week. Enjoy the sunshine. And I'm off to the Isle of Man TT in about 5 hours' time. Bye-bye.